Mr. Reese, good morning to you.
Good morning, Chief Justice Evakin. May I reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal?
You may indeed.
Well, thank you, Chief Justice Evakin, and may it please the court. My name is Jared Reese, and I represent the appellants in this matter. This case is governed by the reasoning of the Court of Appeals in Cummings versus Omaha Public Schools, which was decided more than 20 years ago. Cummings held that apportionment is appropriate in cases involving a prior compensated injury to the body as a whole and a subsequent compensable injury to the body as a whole. In short, if an employee is compensated for the prior loss of earning power, the employee is not entitled to be compensated again for the original disability caused by the prior injury. I emphasize the word disability because it is key here. Cummings and a long line of Nebraska cases define disability to mean impairment of earning capacity, not functional disability. In its decision below, the Court of Appeals turned Cummings on its head. Rather than asking whether Appellee lost any earning capacity as a result of the second injury that had not been accounted for in the award for the first injury, it asked whether the second injury was to the same part of the body as the first. Because the second injury was to the back and the first injury was to the hands, the court determined that Appellee was entitled to be compensated a second time for the earning power she lost as a result of the first injury. It was error for the court to shift the focus from the loss of earning capacity to the location of the injuries. To step back a bit, the governing statute here is Nebraska Revised Statute 48-121, subsection 2. That statute treats the entire body, with the exception of the specifically scheduled members, as part of the body as a whole, and it compensates them based on earning power loss. For purposes of the Act, all injuries to the body as a whole are part of the same statutory unit of analysis. If the court is going to start dividing the body as a whole into subparts, it will do so without any statutory guidance as to what the relevant parts of the body are, and will be required to draw that line in a common law-like way that will present line drawing problems of a significant nature, in my view. Across the board, employees will argue that any minor difference in location is enough to defeat apportionment. Employers will take a much broader view. The back is the back versus L3 versus L4. You can even take it to finer levels of analysis than that from a biological perspective. You know, there's almost always some difference in location from a biological perspective. And psychological claims will be even more difficult. It's unclear if the brain is the brain or if you have to start getting into different lobes of the brain in terms of what's causing different psychological injuries.
So what should the Court of Appeals have done about determining the earning capacity in this case?
Your Honor, the Court of Appeals should have applied the reasoning in Cummings to the factual findings made by the trial court here. And when it would do that, the proper analysis would have been to say, after the 2012 injury, Ms. Picard was limited to her job at Cameco with a 5-pound lifting restriction. After the 2015 injury, she was still limited to her job at Cameco, now with a 10-pound lifting restriction. But again, she had already been prohibited from lifting more than 5 pounds as a result of the first injury. And it should have concluded that for purposes of permanent disability benefits, no further benefits were owed for the 2015 injury. Of course, she would still be entitled to any other benefits under the Act that she might be entitled to, medical care, previous periods of temporary disability. But it would be a recognition that she had already been compensated for that level of loss. The court could imagine that Ms. Picard...
What is the statutory root of your argument there?
Your Honor, it's 48-121, subsection 2, which says that permanent benefits are calculated based on a comparison of the wages before the injury and the earning capacity thereafter. And as the court in Cummings recognized, there's no reason to award double recovery. And that's a line of reasoning that comes up in several of this court's cases. There's no reason to award double recovery So it's about pinning when you look at what the before period is for purposes of the comparison in 48.121 subsection 2.
And help me with earning capacity. What is earning capacity and how do we determine it in this case?
Well, Your Honor, going back to this court's decision in Seidel versus Travelers Insurance Company, there are four key factors that are looked at. The first is the employee's eligibility to procure employment generally. Here, the findings of fact of the trial court established that after the 2012 injury, Ms. Picard was limited to her production job at Cameco, and that after her 2015 injury, she remained so limited. So her eligibility to procure employment generally had not changed. The second factor is her ability to hold a job once obtained. The trial court specifically found that Ms. Picard had remained employed by Cameco this entire period and went even further, holding that it believed she would remain so employed because she was a good employee, Cameco had treated her well. So there was no difference in her ability to hold a job once obtained. The third factor is her ability to earn wages in her employment. After the 2012 injury, the first injury, she did suffer some wage loss and she was compensated for that. Specifically, she lost the ability to earn overtime, and that was taken into consideration in compensating her 75% for the first injury. But after the 2015 injury, she was still able to earn wages in her employment to the same degree. In fact, she received raises each year. That leaves the last factor of her ability to perform the tasks of her employment. After the 2012 injury, she was limited to 5 pounds. After the 2015 injury, or as a result of the 2015 injury, I should say, her lifting restriction was 10 pounds, which she had already been precluded from performing. So there's no delta here when we walk through the factors. And that's why, in our view, the Court of Appeals should have, and this court should now, find that Ms. Picard did not suffer any earning capacity loss as a result of the 2015 injury. The Court of Appeals indicated that it believed there needed to be specific statutory language that authorized apportionment. But going back to Chief Justice Hevekin's question to me, our position is what we need to do is look at the statute that is on the books and determine what the proper interpretation of that statute is, not to ask whether the word apportionment has to appear, given that apportionment is just a label for this type of analysis that we're walking through. The Cummings Court made that clear. In fact, the trial court in Cummings didn't even believe it was applying apportionment. And the Court of Appeals said, no, actually it did apply apportionment and it applied it correctly.
Was one of the, what sort of the environment of Cummings, is it subsequent to the elimination of the second injury fund? Is that, was that relevant to the analysis in Cummings?
Well, to answer your question in two parts, Your Honor, the first is that Cummings was decided in 1998, and the second injury fund amendments were in 97, although my recollection is that the injuries at issue were from before those amendments. But to answer your question about
So help me out then, was the second injury fund applicable or not in Cummings? I don't remember.
My recollection is that it was, at least it was an available remedy. I don't remember that specifically. Mr. Bennett's shaking his head, so I might recall that incorrectly. But what I do know is that
it could have been the environment.
Justice Miller-Lehman, I couldn't hear your question.
Can I be heard now at this time?
We can hear you now.
Yes, thank you. The question was perhaps at the Cummings opinion. Non-existence of the applicable vocabulary of the opinion. I'm not fully familiar with the opinion.
I couldn't hear your question entirely, but I think I got the gist of it. So if you would allow me to answer and let me know if I didn't hear it correctly. Cummings discussed the second injury fund and what relevance it thought it might have to the issues before it, and concluded that the second injury fund didn't affect the analysis. It went back and talked about the cases discussing the second injury fund in one way, shape, or form, including this court's decision in Benson and Heiliger, and concluded that the analysis and the discussion of the second injury fund did not impact the apportionment analysis that case. If I may, unless there are any other questions, I would reserve the slight amount of time I have for rebuttal.
You may. Thank you very much, Mr. Reese. Mr. Lawton, good morning to you. And I apologize. I think your original request was that you would split this with Mr. Bennett, the amicus attorney, but we don't normally allow amicus to argue, and I did not perceive there was any request to do that in this case. So, Mr. Lawton, you're going to have to carry the entire ball here.
My name is Lee Loudon, and I represent the appellee and cross-appellant Helena Picard. We request this court to affirm the Court of Appeals holding that the trial court's award of permanent partial disability benefits resulting from separate accidents to two different body parts should not be apportioned. Also, by cross-appeal, we ask this court to reverse the Court of Appeals' reversal of the trial court's award of penalties, attorney fees, and interest to Ms. Picard. The Court of Appeals' finding that Ms. Picard's permanent partial disability benefits should not be apportioned should be affirmed on three grounds. First, the plain language of the Workers' Compensation Act is clear that a permanently disabled employee may recover permanent partial disability benefits based upon her loss of earning capacity and does not provide for apportionment. Second, the only workers' compensation statute that did provide for apportionment, the second injury fund, found in section 48-128, was amended in 1997 to apply only to accidents before December 1 of that year. And third, the appellants claim that without apportionment, Ms. Picard would receive a double recovery is based upon equitable principles, and the Workers' Compensation Court does not have equity jurisdiction. First, the plain language of the Workers' Compensation Act provides that an injured employee may receive permanent partial disability benefits based upon her loss of earning capacity in two scenarios. One, if she has permanent impairment or permanent restrictions to the body as a whole, or a loss or loss of use to two scheduled members in one accident. Appellants would have you ignore that plain language and place a limitation or exception upon Ms. Picard's right to that compensation. Second, the only workers' compensation statute that did provide for apportionment was section 48-128, the second injury fund. And that was amended in 1997 and only applies to accidents that occurred before December 1 of that year. Now, in several cases that were decided before that amendment, this court had said that absent a claim against the second injury fund, an employer would be liable for all of the injury. And this court has also said, as a matter of statutory construction, that the legislature is deemed to be aware of existing Nebraska Supreme Court precedent when it enacts legislation. Therefore, it is presumed that when the legislature amended the second injury fund statute, it did so with the knowledge that the employer would be liable for all of the employee's injury and apportionment would not be available. And in 2007, the legislature amended section 48-121, which is the same statute under which the trial court awarded permanent partial disability benefits to Ms. Picard for her loss of earning capacity. But again, the legislature did not provide for apportionment when it made that amendment. Third, the appellant's argument that Ms. Picard will receive a double recovery should also be rejected. The prohibition on double recovery derives from principles of unjust enrichment, and unjust enrichment is an equitable doctrine, but the Workers' Compensation Court has no equity jurisdiction. Appellants have cited a case called Cotton versus Cotton for the proposition that the avoidance of double recovery may be a feature of unjust enrichment, but it's also invoked to help interpret the statutes. However, in a later case called Jensen versus Jensen, this court made clear that the Cotton case was based upon equity. Another reason appellant's double recovery argument should be rejected is because Ms. Picard's loss of earning capacity arose from separate accidents. And under Nebraska law, a party may not have a double recovery from a single injury. But here we had two injuries and separate accidents, which each independently took away Ms. Picard's earning capacity. Appellants and amici have cited a case called Madlock versus Square D for the proposition that there cannot be double recovery. But again, in Madlock, that injured employee had one accident, not two like Ms. Picard. Appellants have also cited Ms. Picard's restrictions from the two accidents as if they were identical or overlapping, but they were not identical. As a result of her first accident, Ms. Picard had a lifting restriction of 5 pounds, but as a result of the second one, her spine surgeon assigned her permanent restrictions of no bending to the floor, occasional bending, twisting, squatting, and no lifting greater than 10 pounds. Appellants have cited what they believe are unfair results that could happen if there is no apportionment. However, they have not mentioned the unfair results that will take place if there is apportionment. If there is apportionment, it will mean that Ms. Picard will receive no permanent disability benefits whatsoever for her permanently damaged back.
Mr. Loudon, let me give you a hypothetical. Assuming we agree with you that there should be no apportionment in Nebraska, or there is no apportionment, how does the court determine earning capacity at that point?
Yes, on page 29 of my brief, Judge, Mr. Chief Justice, I talked about the report of Kim Wren. Ms. Wren was a court-appointed vocational counselor, and she went through the factors in Seidel versus Travelers and explained why Ms. Picard still had a loss of earning capacity resulting from her 2015 injury. She said that based upon those injuries alone, Ms. Picard would have 100% loss of access to her labor market. And she went through all of those Seidel factors. Getting back to the hypotheticals raised by the appellants, Ms. Picard testified that due to her back injury, she can't even walk more than a quarter mile and even loses her balance due to her back pain. These are factual findings that the trial court agreed with on page 9 of the award. And I'd like...
What would be the significance that she still has her job and in fact is earning more than she's ever earned in the history of her employment with this organization?
It's only one of the factors that can be analyzed under loss of earning power in Seidel versus Travelers Insurance. And in fact, in Seidel, this court said that if one of the four factors are impaired, that can result in a loss of earning capacity. And I'd also refer to page 30 of my brief where I discuss DAMME, it's D-A-M-M-E versus Pike Enterprises, where this court held that incarcerated individuals can receive compensation benefits. And this court pointed out that lost wages are not even necessary to determine loss of earning capacity. One case that I need to mention is Benson versus Barnes and Barnes Trucking Company. It's cited in the brief, but in that case, there was no apportionment, but I bring it up to show what would have happened if there had been apportionment. In Benson, the employee had a 37.5% permanent disability from a prior work accident. Then a few years later, he sustains another one at Barnes and Barnes Trucking. On appeal, the issues were, was there sufficient evidence to support causation of his injury? And then also the liability of the second injury fund. This court held that there was sufficient evidence to show that Barnes was permanently and totally disabled, or Benson was permanently and totally disabled, and said that the employer has the burden to show the liability of the second injury fund. But what's important is that this court did not order apportionment in that case. If the court had awarded apportionment, Benson would have received a 62.5% loss of earning capacity and his benefits would have been limited to 300 weeks. But because he was permanently and totally disabled, there was no limit. So in the Benson case, this court had the opportunity then to have assigned apportionment. The second injury fund was not found liable in this case. So Benson is just like this case. I'd like to spend a moment to talk about the cross appeal. The trial court made a factual finding that Ms. Picard was entitled to penalties, interest, and attorney fees because there was no reasonable controversy under Section 48-125 that she was entitled to at least the lowest estimate of her loss of earning capacity from her 2015.
Let me ask you about a jurisdictional issue on your cross appeal. When we took this for further review, we denied your further review on the very issue that now you're raising on cross appeal. Can you do that under our rules?
Your Honor, I researched the rules. I researched the case law. I could not find a case that addressed that issue. Of course, there is a rule on allowing the cross appeal. I realize on April 22nd of this year, the court entered an order overruling. Oh, I see my time is up. May I finish your question?
Certainly, you may.
Okay. This court on April 22nd entered an order denying the appellant's motion to strike or for summary dismissal on the cross appeal. I wasn't aware of any authority that prevented me from making the cross appeal. If the court will entertain that cross appeal, I think there is evidence to support the original trial court's factual finding on penalties, interest, and attorney fees. May I just sum up, Your Honor?
You may.
Okay. In conclusion, Ms. Picard requests that this court affirm the Court of Appeals' affirmance of the trial court's award of permanent partial disability benefits resulting from her 2015 back injury, but reverse the Court of Appeals' reversal of the trial court's award of penalties, attorney fees, and interest. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor, 13 seconds.
We have 13 seconds for rebuttal. Mr. Reese, we'll actually give you 30 seconds, 30 seconds.
I appreciate that, Your Honor, very much. And just to briefly respond to a few points as quickly as I can, the bending, twisting, and lifting restrictions that Mr. Loudon referenced with regard to the second injury, the trial court specifically addressed and noted that it did not adopt those restrictions as her restrictions for purposes of the case, and noted that she had in fact told her doctor that she didn't have to do any significant bending, lifting, or twisting after the 2012 injury, and that was something she liked about her job. So there's no delta there. Even if the restriction existed, it didn't impact her earning capacity. And I see that took me to the end of my time.
Thank you very much. That concludes arguments for the day. I want to thank all of the participants on this case and on the other cases for taking part in our virtual oral arguments. And with that, the court is adjourned and you are excused. Thank you again.
Thank you.
Thank you.